Okay, well, first thing I guess I should mention is homework. Turns out the answers are actually in the appendix of my Lesouch lecture notes, and there was a copy floating around. I think Tony gave his copy to Dan Mattis, is that right?
Yeah, Dan Xeroxed my copy.
Yeah, I don't know where Dan is, but I think
it's Xerox.
Yeah, so it's just about a page in there, so you can just copy that if you actually did the homework and wanted to check your answer. Today I want to, after a couple of lectures on sort of going through a lot of formalism, I now want to actually apply it to something and show how you can use bosonization to make a lot of predictions about the behavior of spin and half chains and also lots of other systems, but I'll just focus on the simplest one today, spin and half chain. So the upshot of all this stuff was we had a bosonized formula for the spin operators. So the microscopic spin operators at site J, I remind you, we went through a couple of stages. First of all, we sort of went through the Hubbard model. So we represented these in terms of expressions, quadratic and fermions. And then we bosonized the Hubbard model, so we had charge and spin boson representation. So finally, we can express these operators in terms of charge and spin bosons. And then the final little step is to get rid of the charge boson, which I sort of touched on at the end of last lecture. And the point is the charge boson basically gets a gap from the Hubbard interaction, actually a half filling connected with the Umflatt process. So we can essentially throw away the charge boson. And at the end of the day, we end up with a simple expression, relatively simple expression for the spin operators in terms of the spin boson only. So let me just remind you what that was. So as typically happens in this game of taking continuum limits, we get two terms in the continuum representation of lattice operators. One term, which is a non-alternating piece, which is the small wave vector components. And then we have the alternating piece, which represents wave vector components near pi. And I remind you, going through the Hubbard route, this arose because these involved products of left and right fermions. So we got two KF factors, whereas here the KF factors canceled. This term, I wrote, these are the so-called left and right moving spin currents. So as I showed last time, these are written entirely in terms of spin bosons. The alternating piece involved these products of left and right moving fermions. And when I bosonize that, in fact, the expression that we end up getting, let me just write this as, it's often written, in fact, as N. N is referring to basically the staggered magnetization density, but the bosonized expression for N, in fact, is actually a product of something involving the charge boson and something involving the spin boson. So if you go through the algebra, you can see that the factor involving the charge boson is actually common to all three spin components, X, Y, and Z. And the factor involving the spin boson, of course, is different in the three cases. And it involves, like in general, involves something we'll call the Joule boson, which we'll define in a second. So what do I mean by this Joule boson phi tilde? Well, I simply mean the following. If I can decompose the boson into right and left moving parts, I can define the Joule boson as simply the difference of left and right moving parts. So that's just the definition. So it's just a simple algebra to check that, in fact, the bosonized expression for the staggered spin density, in fact, takes this form. So we see explicitly it's a product of a charge operator and a spin operator. This observation I can basically make by ignoring the Hubbard interactions entirely. So what effect have the Hubbard interactions had on this whole story? Well, what they've done is they've done essentially nothing in the spin sector, I would argue. They simply introduced this marginally irrelevant operator, which is flowing to zero. We can essentially ignore it up to these logarithmic corrections. So the spin boson is basically just a free massless boson. However, the charge boson exhibits much different behavior because it has this relevant interaction. In particular, the Hamiltonian contained an interaction term, which was some coupling constant times a cosine of square root of 8 pi times phi c. And this is relevant, and we expect it to produce a gap for charge excitations. And furthermore, we expect, a physical picture of what happens is this this boson phi c has this periodic potential. And the fact that this cosine interaction is relevant basically means that the boson gets pinned in one of the minima of this potential and only makes small fluctuations around the minima. And we can also have soliton excitations where it tunnels across to a neighboring minimum, but that costs some energies. So we have gapped soliton excitations and gapped fluctuation type excitations. And the consequence of that is that we can think of this operator as having a non-zero expectation value. So this operator becomes non-zero. The expectation of this operator becomes non-zero, basically because we can think of phi as being pinned at one of these minima, for example, at the minimum, phi equals zero here. For this all to hang together, for this to be non-zero, it's actually important that this have the right sign. So we want it to be pinned at zero, not at the point where this vanishes, but in fact, that's the case. So therefore, we can just replace this by a constant. So we'll just write this as some constant. There was always some constant floating around here we weren't keeping track of anyway. So the upshot is this is basically gone. It's replaced by a constant. And that's really the only effect that all the Hubbard interactions had on this story. And what we're left with is just the part involving the spin boson.
So this is supposed to be true for arbitrary U?
This is supposed to be true for arbitrary U. Yeah, that's right. Of course, the size of this constant, for example, will depend on U. Yeah.
As a function of U, that function is known or not?
So the question about the constant basically is a question about the amplitude of the correlation function. The amplitude was not known until very recently. It certainly cannot be deduced reliably from bosonization methods. It depends on contributions from irrelevant operators and details of cutoffs and all kinds of things like that. But in fact, in the case of the Heisenberg model, which is U equals infinity, it was found recently from the beta onsets. So in that case, in fact, the exact number is actually known here. In general, for the Hubbard model, I suspect it probably could be deduced by similar methods, but I think it has not been deduced yet.
Okay, so at this point, we just have to take on faith that the constant is about zero.
Yeah. I think from the point of view of bosonization, the most useful thing is that this is actually very general. So to get to this point didn't depend at all on any details of the interactions. It really only depended on where we were in the phase diagram. And in particular, that we were in the point in the phase diagram where the charge boson got gapped. And therefore, this had some non-zero expectation value, and the spin boson remained gapless. And just given that information, we arrive at this point. And so if we are in that phase, basically everything is completely determined, except that there's essentially one parameter which is a bit hard to fix, and that's the spin wave velocity. So the spin wave velocity also gets normalized by the interactions, but if we're willing to take the spin wave velocity as some given parameter, then we can deduce all kinds of things about the correlation functions just from this expression. And I should mention there's another way of getting to the same expression, which has certain advantages and certain disadvantages over this one, and is perhaps more standard, and this is via the Jordan-Wigner transformation. So I'm not going to go through that, but there's another whole approach to this where you don't try to get to the Heisenberg model from the Hubbard model, but instead you use a Jordan-Wigner representation. So you write the spin and a half operators of the Heisenberg model in terms of spinless fermions. And then then the Heisenberg model just turns into a model of spinless fermions with nearest neighbor interactions. You can bosonize that model. In some ways, that's quite a bit simpler because we only have one boson instead of two. But at the end of the day, you end up with exactly the same finishing point, the same representation for the spin operators in terms of a boson, except that in this case, the boson had a slightly different interpretation. It was a boson that arose from bosonizing the spinless fermions from the Jordan-Wigner transformation. So either way, you end up with the same starting point. There are certain advantages to this one. That's the reason I used it. One of them is it illustrates some of the other ideas that one uses for more complicated models. It sort of illustrates how you would deal with the Hubbard model more generally, including phases where the charge boson wasn't gapped. And also, it has the advantage that it actually fixes the normalization parameter here, which otherwise cannot be very easily fixed using the other approach. So anyway, once we got to the starting point, we can, or this finishing point, really, we can kind of forget where it came from. We can just use it. And now this is really the starting point for all kinds of applications of bosonization to the Heisenberg model and its generalizations. And in at least in sort of first approximation, ignoring log corrections, we can just pretend that phi s is in fact a free massless boson. So what this is telling us is basically that the degrees of freedom of the Heisenberg model at low energies are simply those of a free massless boson. So the Lagrangian for this problem is disturbingly simple. It's just 1/2 d mu phi s squared. That's the whole story. We can forget about the charge boson. And now it's easy to calculate essentially any property we want of the Heisenberg model, because after all, we just have a free boson Lagrangian. The only thing which is a little bit complicated is the representation for the spin operators in terms of the boson. But insofar as we can calculate any correlation functions we want involving exponentials of free massless bosons, we can deduce essentially any property we would like of the Heisenberg model at low energies.
It's only for phi s or phi pseudo s?
Well, both, right? They're related to each other.
Oh, okay.
I mean, so we could.
This is actually for phi s and phi y separately.
Yeah, I mean, if you write the Hamiltonian, for example, we can also write this actually as d mu phi s tilde squared. It's the same thing.
So this is separately.
The Hamiltonian separates into left and right parts.
Right.
Yeah.
So phi left s. Phi
yeah, phi that's right. Yeah. So in the sort of lowest approximation, we can just use this Lagrangian, or more accurately, we should remember that in fact we actually had this marginally irrelevant spin interaction lambda s lurking around, but this is going to zero. So in the sort of lowest approximation, we can kind of forget about it. To be a bit more accurate, we should go back and remember that we have this coupling constant, which is going to zero very slowly, and this is where the log corrections come from. So in principle, there are basically two unknown parameters here. One of them is an appropriate bare value for this coupling constant, but that doesn't matter too much because it's flowing to zero anyway. And the other one is just this spin velocity parameter, which I normally set to one anyway. So if I consider different versions of the Heisenberg model, I vary secondary's neighbor coupling, for example, then the spin velocity will change in some way, and the bare value of this coupling constant will change. But otherwise, I have universal behavior. Okay, so how do I now calculate things using this? Well, the perhaps the most interesting thing to look at first is the neutron scattering cross-section, and I want to discuss, in fact, comparing to experiments. So let's talk about that. So let's talk about S of k and omega, which is basically just the Fourier transform of the spin correlation function. So it's just it's the imaginary part of the retarded Green's function, or I guess up to a thermal factor, or just the Fourier transform of the time correlation function. So, the first thing to notice here is that, first of all, we can't really calculate this in general using bosonization. We can calculate it, in fact, in the limit where omega goes to zero, so we can only get the low frequency part. And in that limit, in fact, we're going to get a calculation. We're going to actually get two quite different terms. One will be a term for wave vector components near k equals zero, another one for wave vector components near k equals pi, and in the middle we can't really say anything using this approach because after all this was only a low energy approach. So first of all, if we consider what happens near k equals zero, then we're dealing with correlation functions for these current operators. So we're concerned with these current operators. Now, it's convenient to use SU2 symmetry here and not try to, there's no point in calculating separately the X, Y, and Z pieces because, of course, they all have to be the same. So we may as well just focus on the Z piece. But that's especially convenient because J left Z plus J right Z, in fact, is just bosonized as DX phi by S. So therefore, we're just calculating the correlation function which for the spin boson field itself. So the point is then that the spin boson field basically is the Z component of the uniform spin density in the system. This tells us that in fact that the spin operator at small wave vector, in fact, this creates a single boson mode, at least if we look in the Z channel. We'd actually like to do this at finite temperature, but this is essentially a trivial calculation. And what's clear is that all the spectral weight is going to be focused just on a single boson. So The spin operator really is a single boson operator near zero wave vector. It follows that SFK and omega then, in fact, is just, we'll get a factor of absolute value of k. So basically delta of omega minus Vs times k, that is to say just a single particle peak at the linearized dispersion relation. In fact, we can even do this thing at finite temperature, and we just get the usual bosonic occupation number of factors. So this then just tells us that if we look at the spectral weight near k equals zero, it's just focused on this line. So since this is a frequency. So all the spectral weight is just a delta function near k equals zero. On the other hand, if we look what happens near k equals pi, we get completely different behavior. So now consider what happens near k equals pi. Well, now we're dealing with correlation functions. We can take any one of these components we like. It doesn't matter if you take, for example, the z component again. So now we're concerned with the correlation function for the exponential of the spin boson operator. Well, again, we know how to calculate this correlation function, as I discussed. In fact, in the time domain, it goes like 1 over x squared minus t squared to the power 1/2. That's the real-time correlation function at zero temperature. Now what we want to do is basically take the imaginary parts and calculate the spectral weight corresponding to this thing. A couple of remarks are in order. First of all, I guess I should have said if I calculate this correlation function in the time domain, it's just 1 over t minus x squared plus 1 over t plus x squared. So in particular, the exponent with which it drops off is actually 2. In this case, the exponent is 1. And it's probably worth commenting why the exponent is 2 for the uniform part and 1 for the alternating part. It just has to do with throwing away the charge boson here. Because if I was dealing with a non-interacting Hubbard model, I'd actually get equal factors in the correlation function from charge and spin parts. And the correlation function would again drop off with an exponent 2. But because I've gapped the charge excitations, I've exactly halved the exponent. I've thrown away half the degrees of freedom, if you wish. Correlation function drops off half as fast, and consequently I get a 1/2 here. The fact that I get this combination, this actually Lorentz invariant combination x squared minus t squared, has to do with the fact that this operator, in fact, involved a product of left and right fermions, so it was actually the Lorentz invariant thing, whereas the other one involved left, left, or right, right, so it involves these non-Lorentz invariant combinations, t minus x squared or t plus x squared. Okay, we just need to basically Fourier transform this guy and put in the right I epsilon prescription to calculate S of k and omega. So, in fact, this actually can conveniently be done using light cone components. So if I define the x plus and minus to be t plus and minus x, then the Fourier transform can be written integral dx plus over x plus, and I'll be careful about my I epsilon prescription, minus I epsilon to the 1/2, e to the I over 2 x plus times omega plus k times an identical integral dx minus over x minus minus I epsilon to the 1/2 e to the I over 2 x minus times omega minus k. So this thing factorizes, and these integrals are trivial. And the conclusion is that S of k, let's say S of k minus pi and omega for k near zero, so in other words, the spectral function near pi goes like 1 over square root of omega squared minus Vs squared times k squared, and times, of course, the step function omega minus Vs times k. So this says, in this case, the spectral weight is not a delta function, but in fact, it's got a power law singularity. And the bottom of the threshold near pi, again, has the same linear dispersion. But now I have spectral weight going all the way up to some much higher energy. So basically, that's really all we can deduce from bosonization, that we get a delta function spectral weight near zero. We get some sort of threshold singularity with a particular exponent near wave vector pi, and that the bottom of this thing disperses VSK, and over here the single mode disperses VSK. So that's really all we can say from bosonization. And we're only getting information about the low energy behavior in these two regions, but of course we can put this together. And the sort of picture that people draw is something like the following.
In the formula for S of k and omega, e to the ikj, so when I go to k to pi, that factor is like minus 1 to the j.
Yeah.
And so in order to cancel that factor, you need another factor of minus 1 to the j.
Well, I'm just shifting. That means I'm shifting k by pi. So
right.
Yeah.
Right. So then I somehow I thought that there would be the cross term between the j term and the n term. Position of S. I pick up a j term from one of the S vectors.
No, that's basically going to vanish by translational invariance, right? It's only when we have a, you know.
They both come from the n term, so minus 1 to the j twice.
Yeah, if we actually sum, if we sum over, you know, more generally we could sum over both lattice points, right? Sj, sk. And then the term that we're concerned with here goes like minus 1 to the j minus k. Okay. Whereas if we had a term that only meant like minus 1 to the j, this would actually vanish when we sum over points by translation invariance. Okay, so this then explains one of the most basic features about the Heisenberg spin-half antiferromagnet, why we have delta function spectral weight near zero and why we have a continuum with a threshold behavior near k equals pi. And this, to my mind, is the simplest way of looking at it, although in fact it's maybe not the most popular way of looking at it. So what I would like to emphasize is you can get everything by just thinking about free bosons. And the excitations of the model are simply free bosons. It's just that the representation of the operators in terms of the bosons takes a more or less complicated form. And the important thing is just that we can represent the operators linearly in the bosons near k equals 0. We can represent them exponentially in the bosons near k equals pi. And that this leads to this threshold behavior here and this delta function behavior there.
Yep. Also there is a beta
Well,
I mean your spectral weight strict.
Sure, I mean yeah.
Zero as k goes to zero. Which
yeah.
Is limit around weight.
So for small but non-zero k, you can see delta function spectral weight. Sure, that's completely consistent with beta ansatz. For example, calculations of the spectrum show that such states exist over there. You know, it's hard to directly calculate the S of k and omega from beta ansatz, but everything that can be calculated is completely consistent with this. And in fact, this behavior near k equals zero more or less follows from general principles. The fact that this thing vanishes with k has to do with the fact that the ground state is a singlet, and this is a conserved operator. So if you take the limit k goes to zero, you're hitting the singlet ground state with the total spin operator, which must annihilate it, and that's the reason, in fact, this thing has to vanish.
What range of k would you expect a delta function?
That's actually an interesting question. So, I mean, the rough answer is it has to be k much less than pi. But one of the questions which I don't think has been answered in this game, which is kind of interesting, is what really, how does this delta function start to broaden out?
But is it really a delta function or is it already?
Or in fact, does it start to broaden out all right at k equals zero?
Yeah. It's k slightly away from zero already.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't know the answer. And it may depend. I suspect that the leading behavior is strongly influenced by this logarithmic correction, this marginal operator.
The two-spin-on continuum that people usually draw is just a bunch of two sine curves,
yeah.
Which
that's
start to broaden out right away.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. But whether that's just an ansatz, and whether or not that's actually valid for the Heisenberg model, I don't know. So I should say that people often like to call this a two-spin-on continuum. From the point of view of the bosonized theory, it looks a little bit different. What we're getting here is not really a two-particle continuum. It's actually a multi-particle continuum. And the important thing is that we're representing a spin operator actually as kind of a coherent this is an exponential of a creation operator. So hitting the ground state with this operator, we create a coherent state with an indefinite number of bosons. So I guess you can think of this as a two spin-on continuum if you like, but I frankly find it more useful to think of it as a multi-boson continuum. So we have an indefinite number of bosons being created over here and only one boson being created over there.
But if the theory collects new state to zero, can one not investigate what happens to the delta function at small pi and
k? Yeah, in principle, one could, yeah. In fact, it's something I've thought about from time to time, but I haven't actually sat down and figured out what the answer is. I suspect that somehow probably the leading effect here must be connected with this marginally irrelevant operator, because insofar as there were no irrelevant operators, it would be exactly a delta function. So the broadening is connected with the relevant operators, and the leading effect presumably comes from the marginal one. So the behavior, I think, is going to depend on the value of the marginal coupling constant. Yeah, perhaps it's more likely to stretch the button. Yeah. But it, that's right. So, because the question is exactly how does it broaden starting at k equals zero?
That should be answered over new k.
Yeah, the answer is presumably determined by the marginal operator in some way. Which might suggest, in fact, that it broadens in some logarithmic manner.
You mean this lambda s you wrote down before?
Yeah, that's right. Uh-huh. In particular, I think if you take the case. There is a special model of some interest where lambda s actually vanishes. This is the model which is right at the threshold of the transition into the dimerized phase. And for that model, it's possible you might actually have some kind of critical point, some value of k, although I'm not sure.
Possible,
no. Well, more likely, I guess, you just have some broadening, which is some power of k rather than logarithmic. Perhaps that's a more likely scenario. Anyway, as far as I know, that's an open question. And I don't think there's any particular reason to believe the ansatzes that have been proposed, because they're no more than ansatzes.
You know, the calculation that was done by Boguzi and collaborators, is that not the exact? They claim to have, used beta ansatz and some conformal field theory and gotten the.
I'm not familiar with that paper. I don't remember it. So maybe take a look at it. Yeah. As far as I know, this is still an open question. Okay, the other thing one can do with this is go to finite temperature. Near k equals pi. Yeah, you got the square root, erase the formula, it's 1 over square root of 1 mu squared minus k squared. So it agrees with the standard ansatz near the bottom of the threshold, and doesn't say anything about what happens up at the top, because it's just a low energy 3. Also, I should say, even the behavior near k equals pi that I've discussed so far is not actually completely correct, because I've ignored the marginal operator. So there are actually corrections to this expression. I'm going to get back to that a little bit later if I have time.
Logarithmic
corrections, yeah. Which is another way of saying that these ansatzes are not exactly right. So what happens at finite temperature? Well, in fact, one of the nice things about this massless boson theory is it's conformally invariant, and you can actually get finite temperature correlation functions by a conformal transformation. Such sophisticated methods are not really necessary, but they give you the answer a little bit faster than sort of standard methods. So in fact, at zero temperature, the correlation function went like 1 over x plus or minus. Well, in fact, it went like this to the, well, like 1 over x plus to the 1 half times x minus I epsilon to the 1 half. To go to finite temperature, it turns out all you have to do is replace x plus or minus t by a cinch of pi times the temperature times x plus or minus t divided by pi times t. So, not terribly obvious that's the correct formula, but at least notice in the limit where t goes to zero, it reduces to the previous formula, which shows I haven't screwed up an overall factor here. And this can actually be derived in a very fast way by a conformal transformation. And the basic idea is that one can map the plane into a cylinder by a conformal transformation. Now, the reason the cylinder is relevant is if we're considering this one plus one dimensional theory at finite temperature, We know that this corresponds to having, if we consider, for example, a path integral for the system and an imaginary time formalism, then we know that we integrate over configurations that are periodic in imaginary time. So if this is the time direction, we'd like to make the time direction into a cylinder, and the circumference of the cylinder is beta, the inverse temperature. So basically, by using a conformal transformation that maps the infinite plane into the cylinder, we can deduce how the correlation function behaves on the cylinder or at finite temperature. And the transformation that does it is just z equals e to the I w over beta, where z was tau plus ix. That is to say, the complex representation of a point in the imaginary time space. But if you don't like the sophisticated method, you can just kind of do it by brute force, because after all we're really trying to find is the correlation function for the a free massless boson at finite temperature, and it's not very hard to do that by direct methods. So anyway, no matter how you do it, you end up, of course, with the same answer.
And
yeah, you can do it that way also. Yeah. So the upshot is then that the finite temperature correlation function is just obtained by this replacement. So we get these factors to the power 1/2. Now you're going to have to do a Fourier transform. So now at finite temperature, S of omega and pi plus k is given by an expression pi times t. So basically, that the same Fourier transform I had before except now I have this cinch function in the denominator with, in fact, the same I epsilon prescription. Times another factor with x plus replaced by x minus. So these integrals cannot be expressed in terms of simple functions, although Schultz actually showed that they can be expressed in terms of Euler gamma functions with complex arguments. But the most important thing for our purposes is just to observe that we can always make a rescaling. So we can rescale our x integration variables by a factor of t. And we see that that's equivalent to rescaling the frequency, or frequency minus wave vector, by a factor of t. So something that we can see immediately without any work is that this effect takes the form 1 over t times some sort of a scaling function of omega plus k over t times the same scaling function of omega minus k over t. And, well, it's easy to calculate these scaling functions numerically or express them, as I said, in terms of gamma functions. And the most important thing to notice is that the temperature, that we have universal scaling behavior, and the temperature sets a scale for frequency or for the energy. Of course, I've set the spin wave velocity here to 1. So a lot of things just follow from scaling considerations, then, without bothering to calculate the actual functions. And, for example, if we if we look at S of k and omega for some fixed value of k plotted versus omega, well, at t equals 0, we just have a power law singularity given by the square root. What we expect at finite temperature is some sort of broadened expression. And the width of this thing is going to be set by t. So the fact that we have the scaling function tells us that basically the broadening of the singularity has a width of order t. And the actual functions can be calculated numerically. Okay, so these results have sort of been around for a long time, and nobody actually claimed to have observed them, tested them experimentally, until actually quite recently. And recently people have started to test these results. So I've got a few figures here. This one. Okay, so this is some data, for example, by Tennant et al. On, I think this is potassium, it's copper potassium fluoride, I believe. Let's see, where do I focus this in?
Maybe this lever here.
Yeah. Yes, I think that's right. Okay, so. So basically, I guess this is, this is more or less S of K and omega plotted versus omega, except it's not actually a fixed K. It's sort of averaged over several Ks because of the way the experiment was done. And the thing to notice here is, you get some peak at a characteristic frequency. As you raise the temperature, the peak gets broader. If this was behaving exactly the way I said it should, I think you should see the width of this thing actually increasing proportional to the temperature. That's not actually happening. In fact, there's not that much change from 50 to 100 degrees. So there are many reasons why this isn't completely satisfactory. The reason you don't see a lot of the solid lines here are basically the theoretical predictions that I've just wrote on the blackboard. In fact, there's quite a large experimental smearing because of the neutron scattering resolution function. So you actually have to convolute the theoretical expressions with Gaussians. And the fact that this doesn't change very much tells you that the width of the Gaussian they're convoluted with must be roughly the width you're seeing at 50 degrees Kelvin. Also, the value of J for this material, I think, is only about 200 degrees. In principle, the scaling theory is only supposed to work when the temperature is very small compared to J. Everything I've done was based on this renormalization group argument and low energy approximations. I think, in fact, it's probably claiming a bit much to say that you've really verified this kind of scaling behavior, but at least it looks like it's roughly consistent.
But at low temperatures, I should see this first singularity in some way.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is you go to very low temperatures in these materials, they usually nail order, and the one-dimensional behavior breaks down. So
if you ask me to just look at the data, it looks like for the first three temperatures, there's a bump at 40 MeV.
Yeah.
And
well, for all of them.
What
40 MeV this month.
Yeah.
This probably just has to do with additional magnetic scattering. This is not actually.
It sort of disappears.
It's because of the way the experiment is done. They're not actually collecting data for a fixed value of K, so they're actually summing together data for several values of K, and this basically corresponds to a peak at one value of K. This would be a peak at a second value of K, and for some reason they're just. I'm not sure why they didn't fit this, and this fitting was just taken from the experimental paper. I think that's what this probably is. Although maybe some other kind of background that's also possible. I'm not sure. So I think one has a long way to go before one can actually claim one has seen this kind of behavior in much detail. Furthermore, as I mentioned, these expressions are actually only correct after logarithmic corrections. So if one was really getting accurate results, one would also, in principle, observe that. But just to show one or two other pieces of data along these lines, one can also extract a correlation length or inverse correlation length kappa versus temperature. And basically, it follows from the scaling arguments I made that this correlation length is a function of T that has to be proportional to temperature. And in fact, you can easily, or inverse temperature, rather. And in fact, the exact formula is basically known. I think in this case, it's just pi times Vs over T. And this spin wave velocity Vs, by the way, is known exactly for the nearest neighbor Heisenberg model. Vs is pi over 2 times J. So therefore, one has an exact prediction for how the correlation length should diverge with temperature. This actually is experiments by a different group on a different material. This was on copper benzoate. And they extracted this inverse correlation length from equal time correlation function, in other words, the integral of S of K and omega over all omega for some fixed K. So the solid line, again, is this theoretical prediction, and the dots and error bars are the experimental data. I mean, the error bars are rather large, but it does look at least like it's quite consistent. No, it just sort of, the density sort of dwindles off towards zero.
Energy, right?
the intensity is dropping as you go towards the upper continuum. There's a peak at the lower edge, and then this drops off in some way.
So it will be invisible?
Well, it'll be very, very small. It becomes very, very small at a higher. So they're not observing it. The intensity gets so small they lose it in the experiment. So what they're seeing is basically the lower edge and a little bit in from the threshold and some broadening of that. But, I mean, there's all kinds of things that should be seen a lot more clearly if they had really good data. Some of the other graphs at low temperature show more clearly the sort of asymmetric threshold shape, but I didn't bring a copy with me. And then there's one more piece of data along these lines. Okay, what this is basically it's the integral over all k at fixed omega of s of k and omega. If you multiply this by a thermal factor, basically I think the Boson occupation number factor, then this becomes the generalized susceptibility as a function of omega integrated over all k. And this function, this is a convenient thing to look at because in this case these integrals can be done exactly what they give as a tangent function. So this is supposed to be a tangent function. That's what the solid line is, and this is data collapsed. This shows nice scaling behavior. I mean, error bars are huge again, but it shows scaling behavior because they're plotting a bunch of data at different temperatures, plotting it versus a reduced frequency omega divided by T, and the theoretical prediction is it falls on a tangent curve. And again, the error bars are huge, but at least it seems to be consistent with that kind of behavior. So I wouldn't say any of these predictions have been verified in enormous detail, but the experiments are beginning to do that. And the basic problem, I think, in experiments is largely low intensity, large error bars, large smearing because of, because the intensity is low, they have to sort of open up things and they don't get very good energy resolution. And they can't get down to very low temperatures because these materials eventually nail order. So there are all kinds of limitations on verifying this kind of behavior experimentally, but at least they're beginning to do so.
The general argument to suggest that when you integrate out k and look at scaling only as a function of omega over t, that should extend to much higher temperatures than
No, I don't know of any reason why that should be the case offhand. I think in this particular case, this was for copper benzoate, and in fact, J in this material is not very large, it's only about 15 degrees, so I guess you could claim that does perhaps appear to be happening, but that's just data down here.
What was that throwaway remark that you just made, that low temperature these materials eventually nail order?
Yeah, that's because of interchain couplings. So roughly speaking...
I see, so there's not one plus one.
Yeah, roughly speaking, well, these materials are always only quasi-one-dimensional. They have weak couplings in the second and third dimension. That's right. So typically they nail order at some temperature of order, the interchain couplings.
But one should be able to calculate that temperature, right?
Yeah, so, well, except that, yeah, in principle, yes. So a sort of figure of merit for any material is how low is the nail temperature compared to J. For these materials I'm showing you, I think it's, for the first material, this copper potassium fluoride, I think it's about a factor of maybe 10. For copper benzoate, in fact, there's no nail order observed all the way down to T equals zero, but the reasons for this are not very well understood. And I think it may have to do with not necessarily small, but frustrating interactions, but that's not completely clear. For the case of other material, people have studied a lot of strontium copper oxide. This is probably the best spin and a half material, but it has an enormous J around 2,000 degrees. And this makes it quite a bit harder to study neutron scattering cross-section because the energies get too high. And in fact, I don't know any good neutron scattering data on strontium copper oxide, but there is various other kinds of data which confirms other aspects of this theory. Okay, so that's all I wanted to say about SFP and omega. I wanted to say a few words about some other experiments. Yep. Yep.
That's a critical point, but I don't know the negative here in the world. Why does the critical point come before? Because then the source for the world originally correct is gone.
Yes.
So how would that look like? Then the source for a finite width is gone at low.
No, there are other sources which are irrelevant operators. So perhaps what happens is this opens up in some manner involving a log, like, I don't know, maybe it opens up like 1 over log k to some power, for example. as you increase k? I'm just guessing. But so the question is, how does the width go with k? A reasonable guess might be 1 over log k to some exponent p. So it vanishes as k goes to 0 and broadens in some ways, k increases. This would be for any model except for the model at the critical point. And at the critical point, instead, it presumably goes like k to some other power q, where this power would be determined by leading irrelevant operators. Okay, so in fact, there's lots of other things I could discuss, but I think I'm just going to discuss one more point, and this is the susceptibility. Susceptibility is actually about the most trivial thing to calculate in the free boson approximation, but it's also the simplest thing in which one can look at the logarithmic corrections. So I wanted to discuss the susceptibility largely as an exercise in how one deals with this marginally irrelevant operator. So the susceptibility, of course, is just 1 over length times temperature expectation of the total spin operator squared. So this, in fact, is basically the limit of frequency goes to 0 and wave vector goes to 0 of this correlation function dx phi dx phi, because I'm dealing with k near 0, so I can... I'm concerned with the part of the spin uniform part of the spin operator. I'll take the z component, so it's dx phi. So the derivative is going to be a factor of k squared, so this is just k squared over k squared plus omega squared. So not to borrow frequency squared, if I use imaginary time formalism, I take the appropriate limit, and this just goes to 1. Well, order of limits is important, but doing it in the right order, this goes to 1. And there's some number sitting out front, which we can keep track of. So the number, there's a number here which relates the spin operator to the product of left and right currents. That number, in fact, is universal. It has to do with the fact that the spin operators in the lattice model and the spin densities in the field theory both obey the same SU2 spin commutation relations. And that basically fixes universally the overall amplitude. So this amplitude, in fact, is predicted. And this gives the formula 1 over 2 pi times Vs. So that's the universal formula for the susceptibility in this approximation. So notice that this result, in fact, is done at finite temperature, but the answer is independent of T. And this says in the free boson approximation, one gets a temperature-independent susceptibility. And of course, the actual susceptibility for the spin and half chain is not constant, but it does go to a constant at finite T. So in fact, it goes through a peak and does something here, which I want to discuss in a minute, and eventually comes into a finite constant. And in fact, this number agrees exactly with the value of susceptibility calculated from beta onsets, putting in the exactly known value of Vs. So this free boson result then correctly predicts the zero temperature susceptibility.
It agrees for the Hubbard model.
Yeah. So the answer is determined entirely by Vs. Yeah. Right, so let's see. There's a similar prediction for a specific heat, by the way, which again just involves Vs. So these things have been tested in various situations. We'll get into that now. So now I just wanted to mention, well, what about this marginally irrelevant operator, which I've been ignoring? Well, in fact, we shouldn't really completely ignore it, but what it does is it typically makes logarithmic corrections. And this is about the simplest situation in which we can look at them. And in general, we can deal with this marginally irrelevant operator simply by doing perturbation theory, except that we have to constantly keep in mind that we should really use a normalization group framework for the calculation. So let's look at the effect of this lambda S marginally irrelevant operator. And we'll just treat it in perturbation theory. But in fact, what we have to do is something which is called normalization group improved perturbation theory. So just doing straightforward perturbation theory wouldn't really make any sense because the Baire coupling effect is not small. The Baire coupling is actually order one. But what saves the day for us is that the coupling is normalizing towards zero at low energies. So if we do a low energy calculation, in fact, we are allowed to do perturbation theory. But then the question is what value of the coupling constant are we supposed to use in perturbation theory? And we can't just pick some number out of a hat. We have to use something sensible. So in fact, what we have to do is put in the effective normalized coupling constant at the scale, energy scale at which we're doing the calculation. So that's the basic idea of a normalization group improved perturbation theory. And the susceptibility is about the simplest situation in which we can do this. So if we go back and write things explicitly in terms of currents, what we're calculating, in fact, is we can write it as integral dx d tau times this Green's function j left plus j right of tau and x dotted into j left plus j right of 0. But now, and this is done in principle at finite temperature, so this could be an integral over imaginary time from 0 to beta. Calculations done at finite temperature. And now what I would like to remember is that we actually have this coupling constant lambda s lurking around, and we shouldn't really completely ignore it. We should treat it in perturbation theory. So if we do it in perturbation theory, we'll get the lowest order result, and then we'll get the leading correction. And the leading correction will involve an extra integral. So we have d2x1, let's say, d2x. Let me write the sum of these currents just as j. So we'll have j of tau and x. This leading irrelevant operator, in fact, was j left dot j right at tau 1, x1. And then j of 0 and 0. And this is times lambda s. And then plus higher order terms. So that's just the result of lowest order perturbation theory. This, where j here means j left plus j right. So once you write it that way, you realize it's actually trivial to do the algebra here. And the reason is this term basically factorizes into terms of the form j left dot j left and j, say, j right dot j right. Or in other terms of that sort. And the reason is that in the free boson theory, the left and right currents are decorrelated from each other. Left and right movers are independent. So this thing just factorizes. So in fact, this completely factorizes into this two-point correlation functions for the currents. If you look at the nature of the integration here, you see that in fact both of these are really evaluated at zero frequency and zero wave vector. So in fact, both factors basically just reduce to the zeroth order susceptibility. So the correction to the susceptibility, in fact, delta chi is just lambda s times the zeroth order susceptibility divided by 2 squared. I'm just sort of keeping track of factors of 2 and observing that each of these factors is basically giving you back the susceptibility up to some factor of 2. So this just gives us back this constant 1 over 2 pi, whatever it was. So we finally get the sort of non-normalization group improved expression, which is that the susceptibility would be then 1 over 2 pi Vs, 1 plus this coupling constant lambda S divided by 8 pi squared, plus higher orders. So that's just the naive perturbation theory result, nothing fancy using the normalization group so far. But now we have to stop and ask ourselves, what do we mean by lambda s? And as I mentioned, it wouldn't make any sense to put in some Baire coupling constant because the Baire coupling constant is, in fact, not small. We couldn't justify perturbation theory in the first place. But if we're calculating the susceptibility at temperature T, what we can do here is put in the effective coupling constant at temperature T. And in fact, it's possible to reorganize the entire series into a series, power series, in the effective coupling at temperature T. And this is what's known as normalization group improved perturbation theory. And that, in fact, is the only kind of perturbation theory you're allowed to do in a problem like this. we must normalization group improve our perturbation theory, otherwise it doesn't make any sense. But normalizability of the theory basically implies that the series can be reorganized in this manner. And this has to do with summing up logs.
Shouldn't that term also be V-S in
it? I've defined lambda S to be dimensionless, so the V-S is only sitting over here. Yeah, the way I define things, V-S drops out. So let me just remind you what the expression was for lambda S of T. So as I mentioned, this effective coupling at scale T had the form lambda naught, the bare coupling, lambda S naught, 1 minus, I guess 1 plus lambda S naught times some number, which I don't remember offhand, times log of T naught over T, where T naught is just a sort of arbitrary scale. T naught is basically the scale at which lambda S equals lambda S naught. So what this basically means is if at some temperature T naught, I happen to know the value of the coupling constant, and I call it lambda S naught, then at some lower temperature T, I can use this formula. In fact, this formula actually is not an exact formula either, because they're higher order corrections, but the higher order corrections are suppressed by additional powers of 1 over log T. So, so therefore I can get a reasonable expression here by basically plugging this expression into here. And if I look at the form that this has, I see that now I've got something which is not really first order in the bare coupling constant. If I expanded this out, this would actually involve an infinite number of terms in the bare coupling constant. And what I've really done here is I've summed the leading logs. So from another point of view, this corresponds to summing leading log divergences in perturbation theory. So to each higher order in the perturbation theory, I get an extra log. And if I sum up all leading logs, that gives this expression. And the assertion is that the corrections to this formula are going to be down by additional powers of 1 over log. So from the point of view of perturbation theory, this is a highly non-trivial result because each of these logs would appear in the numerator. And as I go to smaller and smaller temperature, the logs get bigger and bigger. Perturbation theory would appear to break down. But in fact, au contraire, once I sum them up, I realize that in fact things really get better and better when I go to lower temperatures because this effective coupling is actually getting smaller. So that's really the power of the normalization group, this kind of calculation. It allows you to sum up leading logs. It also allows you to calculate corrections. So it's completely possible to go beyond this order. First of all, one can calculate higher order corrections to lambda S of T itself, and these in fact drop off as higher powers of 1 over log. One can also get the next order term lambda S squared, etc., at higher powers. So this is a completely systematic approach. One can go to as high an order as one wants. It's just a matter of how many Feynman diagrams you can calculate, or one can use some other method. So anyway, the conclusion is at low temperature, therefore, this thing goes like 1 over 2 pi Vs, 1 plus some number over log T naught over T. And this number is universal. I think, in fact, it's 2. Okay. So why is this universal? Notice that as T gets very, very small compared to T0, I can ignore the 1 here, and the bare coupling drops out. So finally, at low temperature, the information about the bare coupling disappears, and I get a universal expression. So again, you might ask, in what sense is this universal? Well, if I consider different spin and half Hamiltonians, for example, varying a second nearest neighbor coupling, there are two parameters that will change. One of them is Vs, other one is T0. And the variation of T0 just corresponds to the variation of the bare coupling. So as I vary the microscopic Hamiltonian, the bare coupling at some arbitrary scale changes, or the scale T0 appearing here changes, and also the velocity changes, but otherwise the assertion is this behavior should be universal. So as was discussed, I think, during the conference, and I won't show the transparencies again, this formula agrees very well with Beta Ansatz results that can actually give an exact graph, essentially. So what this means is that this thing comes in with infinite slope as T goes to zero, which was a result not realized earlier. So this behavior agrees perfectly well with Beta Ansatz. And again, there have been some experiments that have claimed to see this behavior, but it's a very, very difficult problem to see this experimentally for similar reasons to what I mentioned before. You can't get down to arbitrarily low T because the system eventually nail orders. This log behavior is only, in fact, if you ask at what point does this log behavior really set in, it's roughly speaking at a temperature of about J over 10. So only if you can get below J over 10 do you begin to see this. And because this log behavior is relatively slow variation, if you're looking at some finite section of this thing, any other slight correction that has been ignored could easily overwhelm this log behavior. For example, as Rajiv and collaborators have argued, if the effect of J, if J is effectively a temperature of T, a function of T because of, for example, spin phonon couplings or other effects, then a slow variation of J with T could confuse this slow log variation of the susceptibility in the model with a fixed value of J. So, and the other problem is one has to make subtractions from the data because there are other contributions to susceptibility coming from impurities, diamagnetic contributions, and so forth. So, I think it's fair to say that at present there hasn't really been a convincing observation of this effect.
I mean, looking at it, its importance from a positive point of view, I mean, a lot of data over 30 years have been fixed without doing this.
Yeah.
Up to down to pretty low temperatures, and
right.
That fit doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, that's true. That's right. So if you, there was a so-called Bonner-Fisher curve people used before. And as I recall, it agrees fairly well up here, but it comes in something like this. So depending on which region of temperature you do your fitting to, you can get much different values of J. For example, if you sort of fit in this region somewhere, I think that the value of J you estimate can change by about 20%. So.
When most people get J at high temperatures in the
curve? It's probably better. Yeah, typically one would get J more likely by fitting where the maximum occurs here. And this, in fact, does not change very much using the exact beta onsets results. Although if in some cases, as Rajiv has argued, one has to worry about temperature-dependent J's, then, well, the J you fit here may not be the same as the J over here. So it could be a complicated story. Okay, so I think that's probably a good place to stop. So there are lots and lots of other applications of bosonization to many other problems. And I think it's fair to say that essentially any one-dimensional problem that's in a gapless phase can be studied using bosonization. There are all kinds of pitfalls and pros and cons, or any system, in fact, which is close to a critical point, so it has a small gap or a long correlation length compared to lattice constant. Because then one is always dealing in the realm of critical phenomena. When normalization group ideas apply, one expects some sort of universal behavior. It makes sense to talk about universal low-energy theories. And on quite general grounds, one expects that these are going to be theories of this type, although in some cases one has more bosons. So if one is dealing with the Hubbard model, as I mentioned, generically we have two bosons, one for spin, one for charge. If the charged boson is also gapless, then we'll get more or less two versions, two copies of this theory. Or if the charged boson has a small gap, one can usefully represent it as being basically a Sine-Gordon model where an interaction term is added for the boson. If one considers chain compounds or condo systems or many other one-dimensional systems, one can find suitable bosonized representations. However, there are always pitfalls to this sort of approach because, as I've emphasized from the beginning, the whole logic of this approach is really tied up with the normalization group, and one is constantly making assumptions. And my own feeling is that really I'm usually very hesitant to publish any paper with any conclusions based on this method unless I compare them to numerical simulations. So I think really it's putting together numerical simulations with these types of methods which can give you very accurate predictions about the behavior of these systems. So anyway, that's the end of the mini course. Thanks.
Can you answer a few questions?
Sure. Yeah.
I have one about the Hubbard model. In the large Euler method, it turns into the Heisenberg model. But when you bosonize, you only get the SZ degree of freedom. How do you get the transverse?
Transverse spin degrees of freedom?
Yeah.
Well, there was. Yeah. Well, okay. You may have come in a bit late. I sort of touched on this in the beginning, but let me explain that more carefully. So, in fact, I had a representation for all three components of the spin operators, but I was kind of cheating in a way as I went along. Let me just elaborate on that. So, these operators, as I mentioned, all three components of N could be expressed in terms of bosons. They all involve these exponentials of bosons. So the Joule boson came in, and the boson phi s itself. And what about these guys? Well, the Z component This is very simple. It was just dx of phi s. I also have a representation for, say, the raising operator. But it's much more ugly. Involves exponentials, actually, of left-moving spin bosons. So if I want to do everything sort of from first principles, if I want to calculate correlation functions for x and y components, I have to deal with correlation functions for these operators. It's not particularly more difficult than dealing with these correlation functions. Again, they have exponentials of bosons. The rather remarkable thing is that these correlation functions end up being the same as those ones. This has to do, actually, with the chiral structure here. I mean, the important thing is that the correlation functions go like 1 over t minus x squared plus 1 over t plus x squared, rather than something like 1 over square root of t squared minus x squared. So this operator, well, in terms of Lorentz invariance properties, this has what we call conformal spin 2, where it transforms like a under Lorentz transformation in general, some operator transforms like e to the n theta, where theta is this boost. So a scalar has n equals 0, and conformal spin n has some integer n here. So this corresponds to the correlation function for a conformal spin 1 operator. This corresponds to correlation function for a scalar. The point is, if you Fourier transform this thing in the appropriate way to get the spectral weight, you again get a delta function. So, of course, the delta function is completely determined by the form of this thing. And the crucial point had to do with the, also with the I epsilon prescription. So anyway, what I'm trying to say is you get exactly the same correlation function for this guy as you do for dx phi, rather miraculously. And it's completely different than what you get for these guys. And it has to do with the fact, first of all, that the exponent happens to be 2, which is related to this being square root of 8 pi, and also the fact that it's the Lorentz structure is t minus x squared, t plus x squared, which has to do with the fact that this is a left mover and a right mover, whereas this is a sum or difference of left and right movers.
So the Hamiltonian is apparently symmetry broken, but in fact
it's... Yes. So the Hamiltonian doesn't have an obvious SU2 symmetry. It's a miraculous... So there's a lot of miraculous things that keep happening here, in fact. So the x, y, and z correlation functions all end up being the same, even though they look completely different. So this representation conceals some of the symmetries, and that is an objection to it. And in fact, I guess that leads me into an advertisement for something else. So there is another method of doing this known as non-Abelian bosonization, and Hartmut and Thierry asked me to give a lecture on that sometime. So probably to be small enough audience, I can do it in my office, but... If anybody's interested in hearing about non-Abelian bosonization, I'll probably be giving a lecture on that sometime. You can get all the answers this way, except that you keep encountering these miraculous results, and you can make life easy for yourself by not even trying to calculate this and just using the fact that it must be the same as this.
Okay. And this upper boundary of the Pearson spectrum, is that something completely out of reach, or how would it show up?
Well, it's certainly out of reach of any low-energy method. It's not part of the low-energy physics. So I can't conceive of really getting it from bosonization. We were discussing this issue of how it starts to open up near k equals. That is a low-energy issue. So that, I think, you should be able to extract from low-energy physics. In fact, it's an interesting calculation, which hasn't been done yet, as far as you know. But over near k equals pi, where it's up at energies of order j, it's certainly not amenable to these methods. I think you'd have to use... I can't think of any way of getting it other than something like beta on sets.
Yeah, but the question is what happens with the bosons up there?
Well, I think the bosons just kind of lose their identity. I mean, as you start going up towards higher energies, you just can't ignore the irrelevant operators. So I feel like they become more and more strongly interacting effectively at higher energies, and the whole thing just sort of collapses. Now, maybe something elegant happens. No doubt there's some interesting behavior up there. Maybe it's even universal, but I can't conceive of getting it, unfortunately, from these methods.
So you claim that to calculate any correlation function at prime temperature, all I need to know is this correlation function at zero temperature, then I apply the function.
Essentially, yeah. Yeah.
So it's true for the one-dimensional conformal.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. There's a general rule for how Green's functions transform under conformal transformations. So if you make some transformation, Z goes to W of Z. Where in a particular case of mapping the plane into the cylinder, this W is an exponential function. But in general, if we have some correlation, two-point correlation function for some operator, and suppose, in fact, that this goes like 1 over, say, Z1, Z2. Suppose that this goes like 1 over Z1, 2 to the 2x in the bulk for the infinite system. Then the general rule is that under an arbitrary conformal transformation, this transforms into 1 over basically W of Z1 minus W of Z2 to the power 2x, so x being the scaling dimension, times dW by dz1 to the x, dw2 by dz2 to the x. So that's a general rule, in fact, for any conformal transformation. So you can make any transformation you like, not just this one. And this is how the correlation function transforms. This actually depends on the operator O having certain property, and of course, one being a primary field. But the staggered magnetization operator is a primary field in the conformal field theory, so this transformation law applies. If we have non-primary fields, there can in general be corrections to this expression.
How does that lose
entropy? Well, one can check explicitly that in the case where W is e to the I z over beta, that this ends up taking 1 over Z1 minus Z2 to the 2x goes to 1 over cinch Z1 minus Z2 times pi t, 1 over pi t. It's just basically algebra to trace through and get this result.
It seems to me slightly circular. How do you know that the staggered magnetization is primary?
Okay, well, we have an explicit representation here in terms of the boson field phi.
So you need some fancy theory to tell you
that. Roughly speaking, non-primary operators in a boson theory involve derivatives. So if you don't have any derivatives of the boson, it's basically primary.
Right, so you need some theorem.
Yeah. I mean, in this particular case, you sort of don't need all this high-powered technique because you could just do this by brute force. But in general, if you have a general conformal field theory, you don't have a simple representation like this. By definition, the primary operators are the ones, if you like, whose correlation functions transform this way. And in some cases, there have sort of been abstract constructions of conformal field theories where you can say, okay, we have the following primary operators. They have the following scaling dimensions. We might have certain other information about the theory, like certain operator product expansions, or even certain four-point functions. We might not have all knowledge about the theory, but it's enough to know that there is a conformal field theory, has operators with certain dimensions that are primary, to tell you how the correlation functions behave.
What's an example of a non-primary field for the Heisenberg?
It turns out that the current operators themselves, even though they involve one derivative of phi, are actually also primary. But if you take two derivatives of phi, for example, or a derivative of a current operator, this would be non-primary. Or a derivative of one of these cosines is non-primary. Well, fortunately, nothing much in the spin problem. These are some, well, these higher dimension operators are kind of working around. They could be added as sort of higher irrelevant corrections to the Hamiltonian and so forth, but they don't play an important role in calculating low-energy correlations. That's a good point, yeah. That's a good example. Yeah, dx phi squared is non-primary, that's right. Yeah, in fact, that correlation function does not transform this way. It is a correction. Yeah, thanks. Yeah?
The number under the square root in front of phi is very crucial for guaranteeing
aspects. Absolutely, yeah.
Now, if I change this number, can I trace it back to some other model which is the variant of the
Indeed, we can, yeah. So I've been considering SC2 invariant models from the outset, and that basically fixes number for me.
Yeah.
But more generally, if I put in anisotropic processes in the Hubbard model, so the simplest thing to do would just be add by hand, for example, an anisotropic Heisenberg nearest neighbor exchange, for instance. So I could just take that as sort of a Hubbard plus exchange and make an anisotropic exchange.
Yeah.
So in general, then I'll induce terms like this, J left Z, J right Z, that don't come along with the xy pieces. And now if I bosonize this term, this goes into d minus phi s, d plus phi s, which in fact is this d mu phi s squared. So I have some other lambda, coupling constant lambda 6, let's say. So if I forget all my other coupling constants except for this one, my total Lagrangian looks like 1 half 1 plus lambda 6 d mu phi s squared. And I see that, in fact, I still have a free boson Lagrangian, except that I don't have the canonical normalization from a Lagrangian. So I can solve this problem by just rescaling phi s. And that will change this factor here by that amount. So the effect of that is if I move along the xxz critical line by varying some parameter like this, then this coefficient will scale, will vary in some continuous way along that line. So basically everything I've said will hold true. The critical theory is still a free boson, except that the exponents will change as I vary this parameter.
You can still solve it.
You can still solve it exactly the same way. In fact, it's actually easier because if you look at the RG flow, you discover the marginal operator becomes irrelevant. And you don't have log corrections anymore, so in fact the free boson theory works better.